Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 12:30. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. Our first guest today is El Chango, Eric Olson, owner of the Central Coast Distillery, and really the godfather of all distilling in the Central Coast. And we're going to be talking about the rise of craft spirits in the United States and the Central Coast, the path to becoming a craft distiller and creating new spirits that appeal to various different generations. Eric, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you, Barry.
It's great having you here. And then at 1 o'clock, we have two, I won't say old friends, but people who are on the show on a regular basis, and we love having them, Jenny Grininger and Rebecca Kosnick. They are the trustees of the Templeton and Atascadero School Districts. We're going to be talking about Moms for Liberty versus the Southern Poverty Law Center. How the heck did the Moms for Liberty get on a hate map? And we're going to do a follow-up on the Supreme Court ruling Mahmoud versus Taylor, which deals with parental opt-out for kids on LGBTQ education. And then we're going to start with math and reading proficiency, social emotional learning, cell phones, and AI policy. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Eric, it's great having you here. And let's start with you. Okay. I mean, you've got a really interesting background. We were talking before we went live here. You grew up in the Palo Alto area, and you ended up going into the Army. And how come?
Well, I wanted to have some money for education, so that was what really drawn me to it.
Yeah. So what kind of stuff did you do in the Army?
A little bit of jumping out of helicopters, shooting machine guns, and painting my face and running through the jungle.
Wow. How did that change your life?
I think the discipline changed my life a lot.
Yeah. And then as a result of the Army, you ended up getting into the hospitality business. Tell us a little bit about how that all happened.
Went from a green outfit to a white outfit. French chefs yelling at me instead of drill sergeants.
What was your first job?
First job was La Tostana in Napa, Italian restaurant.
And then where did you go? Was that here in California?
Yeah, definitely.
Whereabouts?
Up north, northern California, and Velvet Turtle they had back then.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to chef school in Sausalito, chef school in San Francisco, Culinary Academy. Le Cordon Rouge.
I think I told you I worked my way through my freshman year as a banquet waiter.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to wait tables and do all that, too?
Yeah, I waited tables, bar attendant, chef school. They want you to try it all.
So you learned the business from the ground up.
Exactly.
And then from there, you kind of moved on to some really name. I mean, I'm sure other restaurants, but tell us a little bit about it. I was interested to know that you've been the head chef at a number of the big resorts in California.
Yes, I have. I've been executive chef of Ojai Valley Inn and Spa, executive chef of North Ranch Country Club, and I work for Pebble Beach for the U.S. Opens and the ATM Pro-Ams.
Wow. So you really got it all, huh?
Well, I try to donate some of that time to other things like Boys and Girls Clubs and orphanages in Mexico, Tijuana, and some church events and things like that. So I try to donate some of my time.
Well, that's great. So the one thing I was very interested in when you were at the North Ranch Country Club, there were a lot of celebrities that that went there and played golf there and were members. And you and some of the guys instituted, as they were all getting older, they were passing away, the last dinner for them. Tell us a little bit. I thought that was really interesting. You know, I actually had a death doula on the show a couple of years ago talking about what they do to help people pass on to the other side, as it were. And this is kind of part of that whole process. Who came up with that idea and how did it work?
Well, I kind of fell into it. Every day you'd see the same members. You got to know them, got to know their families. Pretty intimate. You know, year after year, these people would come back every night and dine. And after a while, some of them would actually get cancer or some kind of terminal disease. And they'd come to me and say, I want you to cook my last meal, or I want you to do my wake, or I want, you know, they'd want me to do something for them. And I soon realized that that last meal was something they wanted to remember, some kind of memory of their mom cooking in a kitchen or their grandmother or something. So I'd have to ask them, what kind of plate was that on? How did it look? How was it cooked? I was trying to bring back that memory to them before they passed.
Are you able to share any of the folks you did this for?
I probably shouldn't, but
okay.
it became a little dark at a certain point.
It did it.
Yeah, because you felt like, hey, this is your last shot at something to really give this person joy.
Wow. Well, it's a really great story. So after you're still in the hospitality business, but let's talk about your background and Anna's role, your wife Anna's role. And you've been up here for almost 10 years, basically imagining and building out the distillery business up here in the North County, for sure, in the Central Coast. Tell us how that all came to you.
Well, I built a distillery, and I found that there wasn't a lot of help out there to get that license going and learn how to run the still. So I went to schools all over the United States and threw myself into the ABC laws. And eventually people were coming to me for help opening their distillery. So I had a consulting business, and our team would go in and set up different distilling operations and get them through the licensing. So yeah, we had a big hand in a lot of them. Cass Winery's coming online soon. I'm real excited about that one.
That's very cool. So let me ask you something. You know, one of the things that I picked up was that your name brand is Old Forager,
right?
Tell us about, is that like your signature whiskey that you distill?
Exactly. Forager came from a family way back, great-great uncles. They used to forage for medicinal properties and put it in alcohol, and then they dispense it in their pharmacy in Eureka. It was the Fitzells, and you can look on the internet, Fitzell Pharmacy, and it tells a little bit about that whole family. And that's kind of where I came from, and I used to go up to that ranch and see some of that.
Yeah. So tell me the secret. And when you make a craft whiskey or agave or whatever it is, there's a certain batch limit that it makes it a craft,
Yes.
Spirit. Well, tell us a little bit about how that works.
It's under 200,000 gallons, which is quite a bit. So we don't have any problems keeping underneath that.
So 200,000 gallons, that's a lot. That's a lot of whiskey.
That's a lot of whiskey to produce.
Okay, but obviously that's done in multiple batches, really, correct?
Absolutely,
yeah. You don't have a still that makes that much.
No, not yet.
Okay, well, there's something to look forward to. Well, again, as we were talking before the show, and I always like to stump my guests a little bit. You know, I did a little research on the nexus between the drug making industry and the distilling industry in the United States, and it really does go back to the 19th century, where drug companies and distilling companies were basically one and the same,
right?
And the alcohol was probably just the delivery system for the whatever herb or root that they were grinding up to put in it.
Exactly.
And then ultimately, it was probably the alcohol that made them feel better, right?
I think a little of that, too.
Okay. So I was very interested in learning that there are actually distillery schools in the United States. And, you know, tell us a little bit about that journey, because I think you mentioned to me that you've been to just about every distillery school in the U.S. So Moonshine University is a big one and all that. But tell us a little bit about how that process went for you and how you learned your craft, really.
Well, I did the same thing basically with chef schools when I was chefing. So I went to all the schools available. So I did the same thing with distilling. So I went up to Seattle, Washington, and there's Heritage Distilling, and they have some of the best ranking medals for a small craft distillery. I went to Utah and studied under a gin expert, went to Texas and studied the Texas style whiskeys. Spent a lot of time going back and forth to Kentucky, the Moonshine University, Kentucky University, with the Jim Beam Institute. There's some labs in Kentucky that I went in and worked with some of them. There's never enough time in the day for me to learn. And I'll hop on a plane and I'll fly off to someplace and really get into it for a week.
Really? That sounds really terrific. So, again, tell me a little bit about the process of what they teach you in these schools. I mean, is it just like the actual distilling process, or is it the flavor process? I mean, what goes into this whole thing?
That's a very good question. So I feel like in Kentucky there's families that control the barrel industry, or families that control the corn, or families that control the whiskey industry. And each one of those families has a segment or a lab that has a full family that works behind it. So you go to each one of those disciplines and you study barrels from that family, and they take you to the barrel producers and the rack rooms and how the barrels operate and all the different toasts and the cooperages that make them. Or you study the gin and all the different botanicals with the gin. Or you go to the whiskey guy, and the top whiskey guy tells you all of his failures, and he eats Fritos and he's all tattooed up in cowboy boots, but he's got a master's degree. So it's really a complex but a really casual environment. They bring in food. You think you're going to eat barbecue, but you're eating Cuban food. really a neat place. It's got that southern hospitality to it. There is quite a bit of drinking, so they have a shuttle from the school to the hotel that you're staying in. So they have a good control.
and so there are different types of stills, right?
Exactly.
So what are the two? I think there's basically two primary types, but I'm sure there's variations on the themes. Do you have just one still or two stills? How many different types of stills do you have at the Central Coast Distillery?
I have three stills.
Oh, really?
One of them's a modular, so we can tear off the column still and put a pot still in it. So we can run it and really clean up the alcohol, or we can put a pot on it and really get heavy flavors. So it's all modular. You can take it apart, put different pieces on there. So we have all the apparatuses we need. We can add a gin basket. But we like the column still. That's the most advanced. And they have a still now that's called a three-chamber still in Denver, Colorado. And that's something that they pulled out back in the day, like the 1900s, and they're just starting to develop it again and understand how this thing works. So that's the most advanced one right now, I think, is the three-chamber. It all started with the coffer still, which is like a continuous still where it pumps in a warm mash and runs it through the still, and then you get the spirit out of it. So there's quite a few stills, and depending on how much money you want to make as far as profit, or you want to make quality, or, you know, those things all come into play.
So if we were to stop the Central Coast Distillery, would we find you back, you know, there with an old hound dog, you know, and in overalls and that kind of thing? Or is your process a little more hygienic than that?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more hygienic. I hope it is. You might find me on a cowboy hat on
with
Friday
a shotgun.
Night.
You got a shotgun back there? No, you don't need a shotgun anymore. Okay.
No, we have plenty of law enforcement that come in and you know, have our drinks. So I feel really safe there. We also have a martial art group, Krav Maga, that comes in, so we feel more than safe there.
So it's interesting, because when I was doing my research, it seems that the state of California is actually pretty friendly to encouraging the distilling business in the state. Is that what you found?
I find the state's pretty encouraging about us paying our taxes.
Yeah. Well, they like paying taxes. Yeah. They like that. At some level, I mean, they encourage the marijuana business, but it seems like the distilling business is doing a little better than marijuana these days.
Yeah, I think it does bring in a tourism business. Mm-hmm. I think if it's done correctly, it really does something for the community. It brings the tourism. It brings the community together. They have their own local bar. They, you know, can see each other. Everybody knows everybody by name.
Yeah.
It's a good environment.
Yeah, it's a great environment. I love your place, as the audience can probably tell. So so it's interesting, because so here we are in the middle of a big wine appellation. And, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, the decline in wine sales. And we also hear about the generational shifts in tastes for whether it's wine, beer, or distillation, or whatever it is. I mean, what do you make of this? I mean, when you first started opening, you know, doing distilling here, did the wine industry kind of look down at you?
Well, I think, you know, if you rewind the tape when I was chefing, it was all about the wine when I was chefing. I had to know about Lafite, Rothschild, and I had to know about, you know, Montrachet and all the good wineries. So then I noticed that craft beer started to take over, and we actually had, you know, reserve craft beers downstairs, and people were buying craft beers, and we had to have, you know, 30 lines of craft beers going on. And then the distilling started popping, and now we're into that. So I do think there's an oversaturation of the wine industry, because I do think we're all hung over from COVID. It was just so much drinking during COVID, and now the numbers aren't showing it, you know, because everybody says, we got to go back to work and pay off some of these bills.
Well, and it's interesting. I think most people don't realize, because I did some of this a little bit as an amateur. I think I told you, you know, basically whiskey starts off as a wort.
Right.
Which, so basically it's beer, and you, and then you, what, I get beer. What's the distillation process for, and that's not a distillation process, but there's a fermentation process.
Right.
And then from that, you can either make it beer or you can start distilling it and distill it down into whiskey, or right? Is that?
Exactly.
Right.
You make a wine wort or some kind of fermentation that you're going to distill later.
Yeah.
Depending on what sugar or starch you're going to use.
Yeah, you could even take like the lees from a grape barrel and distill that stuff down too, can't you?
Absolutely.
And anything you can distill.
Day-old donuts.
And since I'm a scotch drinker, what makes scotch scotch?
Well, it's made in Scotland. And it's done with barley, and it usually it goes into a bourbon barrel. So there's those key things, and then they have the different areas that, you know, controls all those scotches.
And then there's the peating process for some of them. Some are peated, some aren't peated, and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting for us, because we have the mezcal, which is a smoked agave, and we've started to mix some of those scotches with some of that mezcal and make drinks out of that.
All right, well, you just anticipated my next question. So tell us a little bit about how many whiskeys are you making, and then what are the other things that you're creating?
So we make two different whiskeys, and then we make three different agaves, and we have a line of liqueurs for different restaurants, and then we have a vodka, a gin, and a rum.
What are the two whiskeys?
It's almost like
it's Old Forager is one of them, right?
Yeah, it's a bourbon whiskey, real corn forward, real sweet, mild, real approachable, real soft. And then the other one's kind of the evil twin. It's 111 proof and has more rye in it, more congeners, and it's a little deeper and darker.
See, I like the rye because because I don't like, for me, I guess because I'm a Scotch drinker, I don't like the sweetness of bourbon. It's just too sweet for me. And I've tried so many times, because everybody around here loves, makes bourbon and loves it and all that kind of thing. But it's like, oof, I just can't do it. But I mean, I can if it's not, you know, too sweet, but still. But and I was amazed. Tell me a little bit about, you know, the agave that you were have made, because you had me taste some about a month when I first met you. And I mean, I don't like tequila at all. So when you first said, I got some agave I want you to taste, I kind of like turned up my nose and you made me taste it. Tell us about that and how that's different. And I mean, that was really unbelievably good.
Well, I think, you know, originally we used to punish our cooks by making them drink mezcal because it was so bad years ago. But over years, you know, the Mexicans have gotten really good at some of their tequilas and their mezcals. They've really sharpened it up, and they've hired some really talented people, and they brought some barrels in. So with that said, I figured my wife, Anna, being Mexican, I better get on the game and do something in California.
What a caring husband.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think there's a little heritage thing there. But yeah, so we did a lot with the agaves. We've done some studies with different agaves, different yeast strains, different cooking methods. We were going to move forward with one launch pretty soon, which will be a spicy agave, have a little bit of heat in it.
And one of the things that's really special about your agave are the bottles. You have some really, well, hold that, because I hear the music coming up. We want to talk about those special bottles, which are just absolute works of art.
Well,
so, all right, folks, we'll be back in about 2 minutes, and we'll wrap up this first half hour with Eric Olson of the Central Coast Distillery. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Eric Olson, owner, along with his wife, Anna, of the Central Coast Distillery, which is in the Valley Fresh Shopping Center, correct?
That's correct.
That's on off of Del Rio and the 101, correct?
That's right, Barry.
All right. I've been there a few times. I remember now. Folks, you can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Tell us about the special bottles that you're putting the agave in, because that's a whole story in and of itself.
Well, I get a kick out of it because I'll see reels of bottling lines and thousands of bottles going through this bottling line. And then we do a reel, and it's just a local artist hand doing a bottle on a wheel out of clay.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a while to get all the clays to actually hold together, and then the right size bottle, the amount that it holds, then the top where the cork would go in and seal, and then the bottom where it wouldn't leak. And this whole thing is an art piece because you have a shot glass that goes on top and then it sits on a tray and it has little tiny serving trays for limes or salt or things like that.
So I take it these are like, they're pottery of some sort,
they
right?
They are.
And it must be, what are they? They're fired at
definitely
a...
fired.
So and glazed and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
food glazed.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So there's a special glaze for that too. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a big deal. When people see it, they go, wow. And I always tease people when they bring their bottle back. I say, I'll give you $50 for that bottle.
They just want you to fill it up is what they want you to do. Do you do that or are you not able? Are you not allowed to do that?
We do it. We sanitize the bottle and we have a ceremony kind of thing. My wife takes care of it, makes sure it's sealed up, right, and it still doesn't leak and puts all the, you know, regulation tags on it and everything, and then we call the person that come back.
And will you find, do people find the worm at the bottom of the bottle when they're done?
I hope not. I hope those days are over.
That's pretty funny. Okay. You know, so I want you to talk a little bit about your place in Central Coast Distillery, and I want you to start with your nickname, El Chongo, because you have special wallpaper in parts of the store or the restaurant with what's an El Chongo.
El Chongo is me, and I got that name at Ojai Valley Inn because as a chef, I think people are intimidated just to come in the kitchen and talk, so I would have kind of monkey around a little bit and make them feel more comfortable, so that's where I got the name El Chongo. And then our wallpapers inside of our bathrooms, we have three bathrooms, and they're wallpapers of monkeys that are smoking cigars and drinking martinis and throwing bras in the air, and people get a kick out of that, and they put it on Instagram.
You're such a sexist.
We have
it's just to say it's okay. Yeah, it's fine. Well, if it's approved by Anna, it's probably okay, right?
Yeah, it's got her stamp on it. I guarantee it.
And before I forget, Anna didn't want to come on air today, but she has a big background in hospitality as well, right?
Absolutely. She was the GM at the Allegretto, and she was GM in Morro Bay, and GM at Ojai Valley Inn, so she's got quite a bit of experience.
All right. And yeah, I mean, I have to say, I went in, we did the scotch tasting about a few weeks mm-hmm. ago at your place.
Right.
And then stayed for some food afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, you know, again, having been in the hospitality business myself and being a banquet waiter, you got a top-notch staff.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I went to another place the other night, which I won't mention the name locally, and I'll never go back because it's just, it wasn't up to what they were charging.
Oh, wow.
For their food and booze, you know. So anyway, tell us a little bit. Okay, so you've got coming up here, we have a few more minutes. Are there, tell us about the concept of the Central Coast Distillery, because you're doing different things, and we're going to talk about special events here, but you also have a cigar smoking area, right?
Absolutely. We did some cigars last night by the fire pit outside. It was very nice. We do, on Wednesday nights, we do a $3 taco. People come in and have drinks or no drinks. And then Thursday, it's almost on the Japanese side. We do sashimi or tempura. And then Friday, we have a prime rib night that's always busy. Saturday, we do some kind of Italian side. And then Sunday, we do comfort food.
Right.
Where you get a price point where everybody can afford to have their family come in.
Now, is it best for people to make reservations if they want to eat?
If there's a large party, they should make reservations. Otherwise, they should just come early.
Okay. And are you open to, you know, doing bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like, I mean, I'm no, they're smaller, you know, bachelorette parties and
absolutely.
Things like that. Because you have an upstairs, right?
We have an upstairs, but that's more employee lounge office style.
Oh, okay.
But we can hold about 140 people inside and out.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. All right.
And we're open for anything. We did a private highway patrol party recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was really fun.
Before I forget, how's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
Go to our website, or they can just come on down, 1875 El Camino, Atascadero.
Well, that I mean, again, I showed up. What was it? I think I showed up on a Sunday with a Saturday with a buddy of mine, and the place was locked up.
Uh-huh.
And you were so kind to let us in. I mean, you know,
there's a guy right there. Let him in.
There's a pigeon.
I can feel it.
There's a pigeon. All right. You have a big grand opening event on June 27th. What are you going to be doing there?
We're going to be live music. We're going to have food. We're going to have all kinds of interesting cocktails. We're going to give tours of the distillery. We're going to sign up people for our membership. We're going to show them our humidor. It's going to be a great event.
Is there a time frame for that?
There is a time frame. We're going to start at 2. We're going to have some ribbon cuttings with the Chamber of Commerce of Atascadero.
All right.
Some local, you know, representatives, and then we're going to go into some live music and some fun after that.
So it's basically an all afternoon and evening event.
I think it's going to go on for a while.
You guys are going to be exhausted, I'll tell you that. All right, and again, we want to also talk about the Distillery Trail Weekend, which you're very heavily involved with, because you started most of these distilleries.
Well, I started some of them, for sure.
And so talk a little bit about that. This is August 7th. Through 9th, and how does that all work?
So you'll purchase a copper card at any of the participating distilleries, and that copper card will get you into all the other participating distilleries with all kinds of freebies and classes and discounts and tastings and just a lot of fun stuff. And there's a website you can go to, and it'll list out what each distillery is doing and what they're offering. We're going to welcome everybody with that card for 1 year, and We've honored it before, and we're really happy about doing it again this year.
So this is, and your website is Paso Robles Distillery Trail.com.
Exactly.
And that's the best way to get this, the pass, right?
Exactly. Or you can buy them at the participating distilleries.
And they're $125, right?
Yes.
All right. So, so then what happens on the actual weekend again? So you just kind of show up at the various distilleries?
Yeah, you sign up and say, hey, I want to hit this distillery because they have this mark of spirit I'd like to try, or they're going to have this class, or they've got this kind of food, or they have live music. And then you get a map of all the other ones are in it, and then you go to so many of them, and then you start getting a nice shot glass that says Paso Robles Distilling. It's a fun event, basically.
A badge of honor lush, right?
Yeah.
That's very good. Well, Eric, it's really been great having you here today, and we'll have you back again. And maybe we'll do a live whiskey tasting on the next one. Huh? What
I'd
do you
love
think?
It.
That would be great.
That'd be fun.
All right. Thank you so much again, Eric Olson from Central Coast Distillery, which is in the Valley Fresh Shopping Center on El Camino Real and Del Rio and Atascadero. Folks, Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, I'll be back on the other side of the break with a bit more serious topic, educating our kids, with Rebecca and Jenny. So stand by.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com.
Protecting What Matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guests are Jenny Grininger and Rebecca Kosnick, trustees of the Templeton and Atascadero School Districts. We're going to be talking about math and reading proficiency and how that's working out for us here at the local school districts. And we want to talk about Moms for Liberty versus the Southern Poverty Law Center. How the heck did you guys get on a hate map? I don't know. It's pretty scary. And we'll do a follow-ups on Mahmoud versus Taylor, which is the LGBTQ opt-out, and what's going on with our local schools on that, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, Rebecca and Jenny, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. So I'm going to start here. You two know better than anybody that I kind of keep researching this show to the last minute. And I happened to pick up an article on Real Clear, Real Clear Education, which is part of the Real Clear Politics website suite. And this is by a guy who's an author who writes about education. His name is William Dershowitz. I thought that, and while he was writing about secondary education, college level education, I think this really grabbed me because I think our whole education system is really doing a lousy job of creating citizens and children and adults that really understand our country and how important it is to them. And I'm just going to quote the first paragraph. He says, it's no coincidence, it seems to me, that the decline of liberal democracy as a fact and value have succeeded the decline of liberal education as a fact and value. If we're ever to revive the first, an essential step will be made to resurrect the second. The two liberals, after all, are the same. They refer to political liberty as understood by ancient Athens, Republican Rome, and American founders, not libertarian freedom from individual constraint, but collective self-government by civic equals. Its opposite a tyranny, arbitrary rule by a single will, a dispensation we're becoming more familiar with than we ever thought we'd be. So I guess I'd like to discuss these various different topics of it, kind of in that context of what's happening to our kids. What are we doing to them? Because, I don't want to sound harsh, but it's almost like, we've got a generation, and don't throw anything at me. A lot of them, they're imbeciles. They really don't. And it's not their fault. It's the fault of our education system. What do you think, Jenny?
Yeah, really, for me, it's quite simple. It's the amount of screen time and access to the internet that they have. It's changed the way that, how fast information comes at them, and it's changed their ability to focus for a longer period of time. And it's rewired their brains.
Yeah.
And so that's really the gist of it. And then on top of that, you have all these mandates from the state, which really have no real viewpoint as to what's needed. And they're mandating things that aren't needed or that are not needed in the way that they're expecting them to be delivered. And so it's just a mess.
Yeah. What do you think, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think that our kids are really lacking in emotional maturity. And I think that that's, I think a lot of parents, probably myself included, where we have allowed the schools to kind of replace us. And, the kids go to school, they're in school for, 7-8 hours a day. And they do sports and stuff, and they don't. And we're really missing that one-on-one parenting aspect of it because we live these busy lives. Yeah. I remember my parents kind of, if I was upset as a, growing up, just grow up, life happens. And I don't think that's really happening within schools because they're putting such a huge emphasis on how you feel and not necessarily giving you the they think they are, but they're not giving them the right tools to deal with their feelings and emotions.
Yeah. I just remember as a kid, my love of country was developed in school. And it might not come as a shock to you, but my favorite part of when I was in elementary school was when they'd give us the current events. We'd do current events and we were required to cut an article out of the newspaper and talk about it for 2 minutes. You can see that's what I do constantly here when I do these radio shows. So, and again, kids just don't have an interest in that stuff anymore.
No, and you can be proud of your country and not love everything about it.
Right.
And I think that's friends and family, you can be proud of them, but not necessarily agree with the way that they're living their life or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with the country. But living in America, and I've been seeing a lot of articles and stuff on Europeans and other countries that are visiting the United States for the FIFA soccer tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
that might not be the right, I'm not a soccer fan, that might not be the right term, but they're experiencing America how it should be, you know, when we're so, when we're living in it every day, we see all the negatives, and there's so many more positives, and we're not perfect, but we need to be proud of who we are and where we came from.
Well, right, and I mean, again, the education system, the news media, it's all about atomizing people, mm-hmm. you know, making them others. Mm-hmm. And then they accuse us of, they accuse conservatives about, you know, always othering somebody else. It's not really us othering any. They're doing this.
A divided country is a weak country, and
that's
it's easier
right.
to control.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit. Let's take this to the next kind of topic. There was a couple of interesting articles this weekend in the Wall Street Journal. Well, one was in the Wall Street Journal, and it's about this National Assessment of Educational Progress. And it basically it was an indictment of the school shutdowns and during COVID that were basically engineered. And again, I know you guys don't want to talk about the unions, but the unions, the teachers' unions, were 1,000% behind this whole notion of shutting down the schools and doing remote learning. I don't know if there was a reason for that.
There definitely was.
Well, what were they?
It's very clear. You should have seen the movie 15 Days. It okay. explains it very well, and they have the video proof for it. The unions had an agenda, and that was that they needed more money to put forward what they wanted, which was more money for defunding the police, more money for LGBTQ agenda, more money for climate change, and they weren't going to give up on this endeavor until they got that, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a large amount of what's taught in our schools, mm-hmm. you know, not exclusively by any means, but I know my own son comes home talking about climate change all the time.
Yeah.
And we just keep presenting him with the other side of the story. You know, it's not one way only. It's not that clear cut and dry.
And nobody's talking about how the UN just came out with a report that said, whoops, really, we overestimated these problems. Nobody right. talks about that.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think they know a lot of that stuff. And mm-hmm. they, you know, I mean, if you just look at research on, you know, maybe vaccines or hormone replacement therapy in women, right? 20 years ago, they're saying it causes cancer, all this stuff. And over the past 20 years, they've done more research and finding out that it's actually beneficial to mm-hmm. women that are my age and above. A lot of that was, I mean, we saw that with studies on the effectiveness of masks and all that stuff during COVID, and we would post it on Facebook or whatever, and it would get censored. All this stuff that myself and Jenny saw the past 6 years is all coming to light.
And really, you know, to me, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. I mean, everybody should have known this inherently already. If you're going to restrict your breathing and not get proper airflow, which is what your body needs, you're going to be more susceptible to illness, and it's killing brain cells. So, you know, and of course, their argument always was, well, surgeons wear them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's, first of all, it's a different kind of mask. It's fitted to them. It's a limited amount of time. It's not all day, every day. And there's more oxygen pumped into that surgery room. Mm-hmm. So all these factors that people aren't aware of or forget, or I don't know, but it was a huge departure from what we did in from what we ever learned about disease control.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was so willing to just go along with it.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys saw it, because the Wall Street Journal also did an opinion documentary this weekend, or they released it, called The Lockdown Dissidents, which talked about the Great Barrington Declaration and all that kind of stuff, that really what the government did to these very prominent doctor, Bhattacharya, for instance, Scott Atlas, with, you know, all these guys from the big hospital, you know,
Stanford
and all that kind of stuff. And they were basically, you know, threatened into silence, really.
Right.
Many of them. What was the name of that documentary? The 15
Days.
And what was the gist of that?
It talked about how quickly everything changed with COVID, mm-hmm. and it was showing the Zoom conversations with the union and what they were really promoting and why they were going the road that they were going. And, I mean, there was one portion of it where Jane Fonda was even on there with them, and she said, "This is God's gift to the left."
Mm.
It just is disgusting what they were willing to do to our kids.
Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, all across the board. Again, if you're creating human beings that don't have reasoning power and they don't understand the country and how it's supposed to work, it's easy to control them, right?
Yeah. I staying on the masks a little bit. I was talking to a grandmother over the weekend, and during COVID, her grandson was in kindergarten, and she was their babysitter during the day. And she said when he went back, and this was his second grade year, he goes, "Grandma, I think so-and-so was in my kindergarten class." And the reason he couldn't recognize her was because of she had a mask covering her face. And he finally recognized her eyes.
Hmm.
You know, and that was the thing. I remember hearing people and talking about it back then where, you know, young kids are looking at faces to get the whole picture of conversations and all this stuff, and they pick it up, especially babies, and they weren't getting that.
Yeah. So when it comes to proficiency in math and reading, and let's bring it a little back to local, but it's fine. No, that's where I wanted to go actually with the conversation. But you know, according to these reports, the children that were really stuck in this, whatever it was, a 3 to 5, 3 or 4 year period where they were doing all this remote learning, they really are suffering. The younger kids who didn't experience that are doing a little better as far as math, but you don't think so, Jenny, huh? That's what they indicated, but that's why I wanted to ask you. I mean, what are you seeing in real life here in the temples?
The problem started before COVID. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was the method that they were teaching. They went away from teaching phonics, and they're teaching sight words, and they're teaching guessing. Really, it's you look at the picture and try to figure out what the words are saying. Don't just read the words, and instead of phonics and teaching kids how letters sound and how to sound out a word, so you could be reading anything and figure it out. And they're getting back to that now. They're realizing the issue, but this
phonics is going to be mandated in California. I don't know when the law goes into effect.
Yeah.
In probably 2021, somewhere around there, 22, there was a podcast called Sold a Story. And it's about the science of reading. And that woman, who I think kind of leans more to the left, she was exposing that the sight-based reading and everything and how bad it was. And they knew that it was bad, but they just kept pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into this program because they had sold it to the whole United States on this is the best way to learn reading. And even when it was backfiring, they still poured more money into it. And we're finally, thanks to her podcast, a lot of people realized what was wrong with it.
So this is another industrial group, as it were, that's you know, just they're spending money so they can, you know.
Education has always been very political, I've mm-hmm. learned.
Yeah.
The curriculum is political, meaning not that they're teaching politics, but it's all about who has the money
mm-hmm.
and who it is that they're following right now. What's the next new shiny thing?
Mm-hmm.
And they forget.
So much money to be made in it.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's government money.
Yeah,
it's OPM.
Yeah, and if you come up with a new way to do something that's better than the old way, there's so much money in it.
Well, again, prove it. I mean, do they ever prove it? Or is it just kind of like the next bright, shiny object?
I mean, I know that
happens in the insurance business, too. You know, there's some new thing that's like, oh, everybody runs to it.
Data can always be manipulated.
Yeah. Yeah.
They make up studies or pull certain data out of it. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, but it's and in the 20 years that was going on or 25 years that was going on, our kids are that much farther behind.
Yeah. So you're not seeing you're not seeing much of an improvement in the reading at this point, or you're starting to see a little bit at the younger ages? And
we are seeing some improvement, but it's not leaps and bounds like, you know, mm-hmm. I'd like to see.
Right.
And I think that if we were focused more on the academics, that we would be seeing leaps and bounds. They're so focused on their emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. Their focus has become teaching them social emotional learning and not academics. Yeah. And their reasoning behind that is that the kids are so emotionally deficient that they can't learn.
Right.
And so we've got to help improve their emotional psyche so that then they can learn. My belief is they're part of the reason they're emotionally deficient is because they don't have any confidence.
Or they haven't been taught.
Right. And if you would just focus on the academics right. and help build their confidence in that, the emotional parts of it would take care of itself in most instances. You're always going to have some kids that there's something going on in their life that is causing some emotional upset. You can deal with those kids on an individual basis, but to have the entire district focusing on just social emotional learning and with some academics sprinkled in is not healthy.
And holding kids accountable.
And you're finding the same thing going on in Atascadero
right,
as well.
Right.
Okay.
And it's hard for the teachers to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
You know, they have the social passing, so it's really hard to hold kids back. And I know that there's a lot of mixed feelings about that because, you know, there's some studies that say holding kids back is actually detrimental to their self-esteem and confidence. But then, you know, but you've also got the flip side of the studies that say, hey, you hold them back for a year, they go into that, you know, say second year of third grade and they are confident.
Yeah. Real quick, thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. And we got like a 30 seconds here. So ask your question real quick, okay?
Okay.
Or make your comment real quick.
Thank you for your information today. Just want to find out, do you know if the charter school here in Paso Robles teaches differently than the public schools? Because I'd like to move my grandson based on the results we're getting.
Yeah, you're talking about.
Thank
yeah,
you.
You're talking about Almond Acres. So Almond Acres is still a public school, even though it's a charter school. They're still mandated to teach the same standards that the rest of the public schools in the state are. So really, you're learning the same things. The big difference is that they're not unionized. So you have teachers that are more accountable to putting out a better outcome.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to square this circle, as it were, talk about cell phone and AI, and then move on to the Moms for Liberty. So folks, we'll be back in about 2 minutes. So stand by. So tell the audience a little bit about what's going on with phones and cell phones. Is that a resolved issue now in Atascadero and Templeton, or is that still pending?
That's still pending. The law goes into effect, I believe, July 1st, where schools need to either limit or prohibit cell phone use at schools.
Mm-hmm.
We are updating policies right now around that. We put out, as a school board, we had decided that we didn't want to make the decision for the whole district on our own. And we put out a survey, but that was, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks ago or something like that. We didn't get a huge response to that, so I don't want to go over the numbers or anything yet. I would like to possibly have them do it again towards the beginning of the school when they're maybe filling out all the paperwork to return to school, so we can get, I think we had like less than 200, and that went out to teachers, parents, and students. So I didn't feel like that was a very good representative of our district.
Okay.
Representation, that would be the better word.
So but again, I mean, so are kids still using cell phones on campuses and doing all that at all ages, all the way through?
I don't, you know, at the elementary schools, I haven't heard of that being an issue, but definitely secondary, it can be a really big issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Templeton has a totally different experience. So we started talking about cell phone usage before the governor came out with this new law, and we're already in the process, and we did the same process that Atascadero is now doing, but we did it like a year ago. We did a survey of parents, teachers, and students, and we did get a really good response. And shockingly, all three of those categories were all very much in alignment that they did want restriction.
Hmm.
So kids are even noticing that they, you know, would be better off if they didn't have so much access to their phone. And so we made a policy that K through 8 had, they could have their cell phone on their person, but it has to be completely turned off and in their backpack for the entire day. No bringing your phone out during breaks or anything. The high school, it's that way just during instruction time, but they could have it out during lunchtime and passing period and breaks and stuff. Hmm. And we just reviewed that policy last week, and we're likely going to be changing for the high school because there's been issues with them still having their phone on. You know, if they could put it on during passing period, then they get into class and they're still on their phone, and it's creating disruption. So we're probably going to have just lunchtime and breaks, and that's it.
And then I gather that the AI thing is now bubbling up.
Oh, for sure.
And what kind of process is going to take place? Let's start with you, Jenny, again, in Templeton, to kind of manage this, because, I mean, I use AI all the time now to do research, but to me it's like crib notes. I still have to go research stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but, right. but
you, because you learned how to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. outside of AI. So we had an AI summit in our district where we invited kids 5th grade through 12 to come and participate in the first half of the day and help form a board policy and talk about concerns that they have. And there was a series of exercises they went through. And then we had parents, community members, and teachers come in the second half of the day and do the same process. What was interesting to me with that is that the students were wanting more restriction on AI than the adults were.
Why is that?
They're worried about it. They recognize already, they know they're using it. They recognize the inefficiencies and the untruths, and that it, you know, they're hearing about the concerns and they're concerned about it too. And they think that kids K through 2 should have no exposure to AI at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about?
And I hope we listen to them.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, AI, I think originally you think ChatGPT and, you know, Grok or whichever. Those actually learn your habits and learn about your life. For instance, yesterday, my son wants an electric scooter. So I put into chat, what's a good scooter for a teenager? And it said, if this is for X, and it named my son's name. And I was like, wow. But then there's also the AI tools that they are using to help teach. I think that has some place in schools, but I think that it's going to get abused by, you know, some teachers, some administrators. And then also, of course, the dark side of AI is the AI generated inappropriate pictures that they right. make of fellow students and everything. So it's a huge can of worms that it's opened up, and I we're not going to be able to get away from it, and I'm not saying embrace it, but we need to find a balance between, and we're actually going over our AI policies right now, but there needs to be a balance because it can be used and abused for sure. And it is collecting data for
yep.
everything that you're doing. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I use Perplexity, mm-hmm. which is, I haven't even tried any of the other ones yet, but I mean, I can tell it's learning. It's already suggesting things that I want to know next because it's figured me out.
Yeah. Well, type your name in. Say, hey, tell everything you know about me. It'll be amazing to see what it pulls up.
That would be a scary read. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and really what that does then is it's not stretching your brain.
Right.
Right. It's not saying, right. well, have you considered these other things? This wouldn't be usual for mm-hmm. you, but here's these other aspects. So it's really shortchanging everybody in, when it's doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. So just before we go on to Moms for Liberty and the SPLC, what's the next learning thing that's going to be a problem? I mean, are you looking down the road after AI and all this? Are you seeing anything?
Math is going to be the next soul to story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Math is suffering more than reading is mm-hmm. at this point. And you know, it's hard to decipher it all because you have this state testing, the CASP, right? Mm-hmm. And the kids are not, it doesn't affect their grade. So a lot of times kids are not even trying and like they're done with the exam in 10 minutes, which you know that they didn't do it then. They mm-hmm. just filled out whatever. So the results that you're seeing are very, very skewed. And then, you know, how do we develop a test that's going to really, truly test what they know so that you can then build upon that? And that's what we've got to focus on is what's the testing that we can get done that's going to be more accurate.
Yeah. I noticed, I saw a news story about how Google has actually, they actually have created universities for kids to learn how to be electricians. And they're giving scholarships because they're going to have such a huge demand for electricians for all of these data centers that they're building and stuff
but
like that.
But not online schools.
No, they're actually...
Hands-on.
Yeah, hands-on schools.
So now Google's competing with the... with the trade schools?
Possibly, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah. So, all right, let's move on. You know, the SPLC Moms for Liberty story has been in the news. I think, you know, Moms for Liberty kind of got dragged into it, in my opinion. It was just the overhaul view, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. But SPLC is under indictment, I think, from the Department of Justice for basically hiring hate groups so they can continue to raise money to write about hate groups.
Yep. Right.
And this could very well be because there is no hate or very little hate, and they have to gin it up so they can keep getting their donors to write big checks. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah. Moms for Liberty, you guys are big Moms for Liberty folks. They got dragged into this whole thing recently. Tell us about that.
Well, it's not recently. SPLC dragged us into it from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
2023 is, I think, when we officially made it onto the hate map.
Yeah. Yep. So,
anti-government group is what an anti-government extremist group, and I am pretty anti-government, so I don't know that I don't know that I'm an extremist, but I don't really have a problem with that.
Well, America is built upon being not all about government, so. I think that's probably why we have the viewpoint that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Government is supposed to be pretty limited,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's become not at all limited. It's running our lives, and so we're supposed to be running the government, not the other way around. And
what a revolutionary thought!
Right, right. it's we the people, not we the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the opposition is going to say they were spending their donor money to have spies infiltrate some of those groups to prove that, you know, it's a hate group.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't doing just that.
Mm-hmm.
They were also using that donor money to purchase things for the hate groups, like with the KKK, burning crosses, mm-hmm. and things such as that. Which you're then promoting that group and promoting the hate. So their argument to me doesn't hold up.
Right.
And when you know, we're definitely very well aware of what Moms for Liberty is about. There's no secret in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
To say that it's a hate group is such a far reach that's nowhere near that. I just know that then there's an issue there that they're lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems to me it looks like Moms for Liberty is working with the Heritage Foundation on
right.
a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information request from who exactly? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm not
is it
quite sure.
Is it from the government or is it from?
I'm not aware of the
yeah,
FOIA request,
yeah.
but we do often work together mm-hmm. with the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah. No, it's a good group.
It is.
Yeah. So
I know they did some FOIAs for the Biden administration because we were, you know, on their terrorist
mm-hmm.
lists. You know, and we were in Philadelphia and we had all of at our summit. We had, you know, they had like a street festival of protesters. Those people were paid.
Mm-hmm.
One of our chairs from Seattle was coming and she was sitting stuck in the airport for hours because of bad weather. And some of the protesters were sitting behind her and they were actually talking about their Visa gift card that they were given. And that was flying them to protest in Philadelphia at our summit. And then they were talking about flying down to, I believe it was Orlando for a TPUSA protest
mm-hmm.
after. And it was all off of those gift cards. I don't know who was paying, but I know that whoever was paying them was probably working with SPLC and other organizations that were similar.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many of these organizations that started off doing good good things, or at least we thought they were doing good things. Maybe they haven't from the beginning, but, you know, when you're originally starting off in the 60s fighting the KKK, that's a good thing.
Right.
And then you find out that they're funding modern-day KKK. Yeah. You know, it's just, it's crazy. It's always...
Something changed there, for sure.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of the Daily Wire, and I listen to Matt Walsh, and I mean, he's doing a whole series on racism right now.
He loves
now.
Moms for Liberty, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Mm-hmm.
His sister's in one of our chapters.
Oh, yeah? That's cool. I mean, he's a very smart guy. I mean, you listen to his stuff, and I say, well, this is definitely revisionist history, but maybe, you know, there's probably a truth, lots of kernels of truth in what he's saying. That, you know, I mean, went from the Cesar Chavez revelations to the Martin Luther King revelations. I mean, it's interesting what we don't know.
And if you're not teaching real history,
you're
just bound to repeat it.
Yeah. So let's move on to one of my least favorite topics, is the whole LGBTQ stuff. I was thinking about that coming over. I was going to ask you a question about it, but we've spent a lot of time on Mahmoud versus Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
So just give a real quick summary of what that Supreme Court ruling was. That was last year, right?
Yeah, I think.
And Moms for Liberty was really involved with this, right? Correct?
Yes. Yeah. A couple of the moms that we have that brought that lawsuit were Moms for Liberty members. So,
right.
Yeah, we had Roslyn was on with me months ago. Yeah.
Right. So it really stems from a school district on the East Coast that was teaching curriculum that was LGBTQ related, and they were offering an opt-out. And then at some point, there were so many parents exercising the opt-out that they decided to quit offering that and force the curriculum. And that's when parents started to sue. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, which is really beneficial because now it affects not just them, it affects all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And in the state of California, we have a law that requires our district to teach LGBTQ curriculum. We didn't have a way around it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we do, because the school districts are supposed to be telling parents that what it is exactly that they're teaching, and then provide you with the opt-out. And so... I know for sure in Templeton for seventh grade, there's a whole chapter of that's about the LGBTQ that they're supposed to be teaching. And I think that probably most parents aren't aware that that's there, number one. They know they have an opt-out for the sex ed, but they're not being informed about the LGBTQ component. And they don't know that they can opt out of just that portion. They don't have to opt out of the whole sex ed unless they want to. But they can opt out of that portion.
And this goes into the PRISM training for teachers, which is like an anti-discrimination training that's now required. PRISM itself was teaching that, saw screenshots of it today or slides of it today, where they are not required by law. It tells them that you are not required by law as a teacher to tell the parents if their student wants to go by a different name or gender or whatever at school.
Right.
But today, actually, I was watching a video that Sonia Shaw, who's running for state superintendent, so vote for Sonia in November, she logged into the PRISM training, and there's now like a warning on there that says, that states the Mahmoud versus Taylor lawsuit, and that they cannot, they have to give an opt-out to teachers or to parents about
mm-hmm.
it. So that's actually wormed its way into the teacher's training.
So are the opt-outs in place, available now and in place in Atascadero and Templeton schools?
They are in our school district, but I don't believe that they are as robust as they could be or should be.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, everybody's aware you have an opt-out for sex ed, but if you're not being specifically told that there's LGBTQ components and letting you know that you can opt out of just a portion of it if you wish, parents aren't going to realize that and exercise their right. So, there's a lot of mistrust that's happened since COVID.
Hmm.
And if the school districts, they're constantly talking about the chronic absenteeism and how horribly it's impacting us. If they really wanted to improve that, they would work on the transparency. And this is one way to do it.
And again, I know you were involved with a controversy regarding whether it applied only to, what, K K through eight versus K through 12, and where does that stand in the districts here?
We haven't specifically talked about that, but depending on the lawyer, your representation, even within the same, Lozano Smith, say, depending on what lawyer you talk to, some will say it's K-5, some will say it goes all the way up to
12th grade.
12th grade or when they turn 18.
Okay. So what about in Templeton?
In Templeton, they finally have decided it's all grades, K through 12.
Okay, nobody's pushing back on that.
No, they're not.
All right. So in the last minute here...
Your religious liberties don't end at age 11.
No kidding.
Okay, so that's what the lawsuit is all about.
Yeah.
I specifically asked the CSBA lawyers whether a...
CSBA is...
California School Board Association, okay. at their conference, whether a student who is of a religion that their parents aren't, if they can opt themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, so, and we should also say that these are our individual opinions and not necessarily representative of the board.
Right. Exactly. That's fine. That's
yeah.
Thanks for that disclaimer. We got about 30 seconds, so we may have to take this on to the other side of the break. When you walked into the studio today, you said to me, don't forget to ask me about the Trevor Project. What the heck? This is something new that you have to deal with now, right?
Yeah. So California has enacted another law. That is, you know, we've always had a law in place that required us to provide something on the student's ID card for suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. And it was a generic suicide hotline, right? Now it's required specifically to be the Trevor Project. And the Trevor Project is specific to LGBTQ. So now you're ignoring all the other students who may be suicidal. And this is the only avenue that they're being directed to. So I have a solution that I would propose, and we can talk about that after the break.
Yeah, I actually hear the bumper music again, so I think we're back on. We're doing good. So, okay, folks, we'll be back in about 3 minutes, and we'll wrap this up with Jenny and Rebecca. So stand by. And we're back with Rebecca Kosnick and Jenny Grinninger, trustees of the Templeton-Atascadero School Districts. You can still call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show, I do some different kinds of shows here. My first guest is going to be my neighbor and friend, Ed Lysak, who is a guru of orchids, and he is the chairman of the Five City Orchid Society here in Slo County, and they're having a big event on the 27th, I believe. And we're going to talk all about orchids and why orchids make a difference in your life. I got to hear that. And then District 1 Supervisor John Pishong will come on and talk about, I'm sure everything about Slo County government and all that type of thing. And also, folks, by the way, don't forget that RP Slo is doing a 250 Years of Freedom barbecue on June 28th at Templeton Park. And I'm sure you want to go to that. It's a lot of fun. So you want to go to
Easy for you to say.
I know.
CO, probably.
It's been a long show. I wasn't drinking with Eric in the first segment either. RPSLOC.org. God almighty. It's been one of those days. All right. Let's go back to this Trevor Project. So basically, they're worried about kids committing suicide, but only gay kids or LGBTQ+ kids.
Right. So the problem with the Trevor Project, as I see it, is that it offers chat rooms for 13 to 24 year olds. So they're automatically placing minors with adults. In the research that we've done in Moms for Liberty, we see that the adults are inviting kids to go off of that platform and meet on Discord, which is a known sex trafficking. They're predators.
Yeah.
So you're taking kids who are really vulnerable and potentially suicidal, and you're making the problem worse. There's all kinds of sexual talking to the kids. There's been evidence of the kids themselves saying, I don't feel safe here. You know, can somebody come in and intervene? This isn't right. So they recognize that it's not good. And why we would want to expose our kids to that, I have no idea. My solution is, if we have a state law that's requiring us to put this on the back of every student ID, there's nothing stopping us from creating two different student IDs, one with the Trevor Project and one with a generic suicide hotline. And the parent can decide which one they want their kid to have. We're following the law then. We're making student IDs with it on there. And it's the parent who's in control over which one their student should have.
Yeah, whatever happened to the parent getting a call and just saying, I think your kid's got some issues. You know, you need to see, get him some help, him or her some help.
Right.
I mean, what is wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it. And actually, you know, this one of the things that the PRISM training, hopefully, they're also doing is talking about Mirabelli versus Bonta, because that has a direct impact on the PRISM training. That is a Supreme Court lawsuit that is that two teachers from San Diego started saying, we're not willing to keep secrets from parents. Our religious rights are preventing us from doing that. And they were fired. So they got their jobs back. And now the whole nation, again, is impacted by this decision, which is a really good one.
And who's pushing this Trevor Project thing? Who's behind that? Is it a state law?
It's a state law.
Okay, so it's something it's that California. Our goofy legislature
passed. Yeah, I'm sure it's funded by Planned Parenthood and California Teachers Association.
Okay.
Those kind of the same gang of
a lot of corporations are behind the Trevor Project. Mm-hmm. And my guess is they really have no idea. They think it's something good that's for kids that are LGBTQ related, and they think they're doing something positive in protecting them, but it's actually doing the opposite.
Yeah. I'm at this point, I mean, you're being kind, I think. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, because I don't trust anything that's coming out of the California state legislature
anymore. Well, I'm talking about other, like Nike and, you know, you can, Coca-Cola probably is on. I can't remember all the different, there's so many. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost every corporation is involved in supporting the Trevor Project.
I believe it was started after a kid named Trevor was killed. And so, much like the SPLC, I think it started with good intentions. And
yeah.
It was hijacked. And we had a chapter chair in Riverside who went undercover as a 14-year-old, and she was the one that exposed it and was invited into those Discord chat rooms and with very inappropriate conversations. So it's happening. People will say it's not, but it is absolutely happening.
In the last 30 seconds we have, I want to circle back to community schools, because you brought on with one of the times you were on the last time, where you brought in Kelly Shenkowski. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this gets back to your original comment about the government and unions and teachers and school districts getting between their kids and what's right and wrong. So give us an update on community schools, Rebecca.
The update is they're still pushing them.
Are they?
And it's just a lot of, you know, some of the extended school year funds is part of that community school outreach, where they're saying, hey, you're a little bit behind, you know, you can come into school, but it's really just keeping the kids longer.
Yeah.
With you know, all of the clinics and stuff that they're putting on the campuses, whether it's, you know, silly things like, you know, eye exam or teeth exam, it's all the same thing.
Yeah, so it's intervening in the parents' role,
taking money from the kids.
All right, guys, it's been great having you. I think we got almost all the topics in. Thanks again. We'll see you soon, huh?
Thank you.
Folks, I'll see you next week with Orchids and John Pashon. How's that? So you have a great week. Thank you.